Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted over at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, February 15th, 2009, and this is show number 191. Well, before I kick into gear here, I want to give a special shout out to Will for all the work he did to create a fantastic script for me. It helps me get GarageBand set up for the show every week. Here's the problem. GarageBand 09 has some really weird default settings for a new podcast recording. For example, it has the metronome on. Oh yeah, that's what you want to hear. Tick, 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 tick. Right. It shows beats instead of seconds on the timeline. Why would I want beats if it was a podcast? That doesn't make any sense. And it even has reverb turned on by default for the voices. Well, last week I was complaining about it during the setup for the live show over at ustream.tv/nosilicast, 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 every Sunday night. And I was complaining about all these things I had to set up every single week. And Will offered to create a script for me to do all that with a single click. Or maybe I think it's a double click. I told him there were a few other things that I've been setting by hand each week in GarageBand 08, like hiding the podcast track and setting my voice track to mono. So he incorporated those things too. Would you believe he even set it up to name the podcast episode automatically? He noticed that the shows are all named NC, followed by the year, month, and day. And he figured I always start the recording on the same day as the name of the file, so he made it grab the date and puts it right into the title exactly in the format I always do. So now all I have to do to get started is double-click the script, and when GarageBand is ready, it'll ask me where to save the file. Isn't that fantastic? As if that weren't all enough, he even made a neato icon for it. So, I mean, it's even beautiful. One of the fun things as he was setting this up is he said, so send me some screenshots so I know what you want me to fix. And he says, and send it to me in a Screen Steps tutorial, would you? I gotta love that. So, of course, that's exactly what we did. Well, on the Mac Roundtable, we recorded today, show number 58, which should be out, I think, tomorrow. Well, we each got to do a pick at the end. And you know what I picked? I chose people who write scripts for me. That was my pick. I told him about Will's script and also about the one Connor wrote for me a little while ago. That's the one that turns off network time syncing and launches Skype for me, because if you don't turn that off, it causes Skype dropouts. He wrote this great script that does it all for me. And the best part about the discussion on the Mac Roundtable was all the other podcasters on the call said, hey, how do you get him to do all this work for you? I loved it. And No Silicast listeners are the best. Speaking of the best listeners, George from Tulsa sent me a fabulous gift. He sent me a beautiful 6-foot vinyl banner with the No Silicast logo on it. It's just gorgeous. Now I have to find some events to present at so I can show it off. I put a picture of it in the show notes so you can see how cool it looks. Thanks, George. You rock. Well, I had a wild weekend of recording this weekend. I did 5 recordings. Not only this, the No Silicast here, and the Mac Roundtable that I mentioned, but I also did one of my segments for Tim Verporten's Mac Reviewcast, too. On top of that, I did 2 interviews, and those were a blast, too. David Allen has a show called Mac 20 Questions Podcast, hosted over at mac20q.com. The idea he has is that he interviews Mac people, and he asks them the same 20 questions. He decided that for some reason, maybe I would be interesting. Well, David and I had a lot of fun chatting, so I hope you'll head over and check out his show. It should be up pretty soon. One of the things I like about podcasting is how international it is. And David was the first person I've ever talked to who's actually in Spain. That was neat. Well, speaking of international, I also had the pleasure of being interviewed by Nightwise, who, as you know, is from Belgium. Remember Nightwise? He's a Linux Mac smart guy who helped me with my Ubuntu OLPC installation and came through with a Honda Bob commercial. Nightwise and I had a blast talking. I think we could have talked for 3 hours without stopping. If you haven't had enough of me by now, head on over to nightwise.com and click on Nightcast on the left for the audio podcast. You can also check out KWTV for really hardcore geekery where Nightwise teaches about how to do fun things with Linux. By the way, Knight is K-N-I-G-H-T. Now it's time for a serious note. The No Silicast needs your help. My honor is at stake here, and I'm issuing a call to arms. You see, a few years back, my buddy Ron and I went to the Podcast Expo, and at one of the parties, the French maids were from French Maid TV were on stage. They asked for volunteers to come up on stage with them. Well, you know the Mac Roundtable hasn't nicknamed me Pick Me, Pick Me, for no good reason, right? So I ran up, and I had a great time with them and their shenanigans. Ron was alert enough to take a few photos, and he posted one on Flickr of me with the French maids. He was telling me on Friday night that this photo has the most views of any photo he's ever posted on Flickr. It's gotten 4,860 views so far. Well, on Saturday, I was telling Bart about this, and he had the audacity to suggest that the numbers had nothing to do with the fact that the internationally famous Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast was in the photo. He thought it was because there were French maids in it. Can you imagine? What is he thinking? It's obviously because I'm in the photo, I'm sure. Who would want to go look at French maids anyway? Well, in order to make a point, here's what I want you to do. I need every single one of you to go follow the link I put in the show notes to the photo. I don't just want to break 5,000 on this photo. I want to see us break 6,000 on the photo. I want to prove that the power of Podfeet is in full force. If you have to tell your friends and neighbors to follow the link, I'm sure they'll be willing to force themselves to look at a picture of the French maids if that's what it's going to take to make this point. Let's really blow this out of the water. If you're too lazy to go to the show notes, you can just go to Flickr.com and type in French maids. It's the 11th picture. I know that's going to force you to scroll through about 10 pictures of French maids first, but you do realize my honor is at stake here, right? There's a problem that's been bothering me for about a decade. I ran into an old friend of mine recently, and I remembered that he was pretty good at optics, so he might be able to answer my question. You see, here's the deal. I've got an astigmatism in my right eye. Now, you've probably played with glasses that correct for astigmatism. That's when your eye is actually out of round, so the glasses are out of round, too. The fun part is to take the glasses in your hands and rotate them back and forth and watch the distortion move around. But here's the weird part that's been bugging me for 10 years. I wear glasses to correct for it sometimes. Most of the time, I wear contacts. But when I'm wearing my glasses, I've noticed that if I rotate my head on my neck, holding my shoulders still, my vision skews and warps. Now, I would certainly expect that if I were holding my glasses still and moving my head, or holding my head still and rotating the glasses. But why does it skew and look funny if I move my head and glasses together? Here's one more data point. If I rotate my whole upper body, the vision does not skew. So what am I doing? Bending my optic nerve or something? Like I said, this had been bothering me for ages. Well, I'm delighted to report that my friend John has figured it out. If you want to experiment first to see if you can figure it out, don't listen to this next part until you're stumped. I particularly like how he wrote it too, so you can tell we're old friends. Here's what he wrote. After extensive research, I have the solution to your dilemma. When you roll your head, your eyeballs roll in the opposite way in their sockets. At least mine do. Try this. Look closely in a mirror at your bloodshot eyeballs and note the position of the blood vessels relative to your droopy eyelids. Now roll your head left or right and notice how your eyeballs try to de-roll as your head tilts. That messes up your vision because your glasses are ground to correct astigmatism at a specific angle relative to your eyeballs. Mystery solved. At least that's how it works for me. He actually wrote back later and pointed out that if you do your whole shoulders and body, if you wait long enough, your eyes actually roll into the right position. They undo the de-rolling. So anyway, I was just so excited about this. This has driven me crazy. I've asked my eye doctor about it, and they never had a good explanation. They just always said, oh, it's because, you know, the glasses are ground for a certain angle. And I was like, yeah, I know, but I was moving my head. So that one made me really, really happy.
Dumb.
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 Dumb questions.
Dumb questions. Dumb questions.
What do I? What is?
How come I always have to?
It's time for Dumb Question Corner.
Hi, Allison. This is David from Oklahoma, and I have a dumb question about my iDisk. What I'm wondering is, if I take a folder from my local hard disk and drag it to my iDisk, I know the contents of the folder get copied to the iDisk, and then the iDisk syncs with .Mac. If I then make changes to the contents of that file, or add or subtract files or change individual files within that folder, do those changes automatically get synchronized over to my iDisk, or do I have to manually synchronize the files? That's my dumb question, and I hope it's a good one. As always, I love the show, so keep up the good work, and I look forward to many more episodes. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your kind words, David. I got to tell you, I actually didn't get how that's supposed to work. We even talked about it on the Mac Roundtable today, so I could try to get an answer and really understand how that stuff's supposed to work. I complained to Steve tonight that I didn't know what the answer was, and he said, well, why don't you run a test? I was like, oh, duh, I guess I could do that. So I created a folder called test. I put a text file in it with a few words. I dragged that folder to my iDisk. Then I went to the folder on my machine, and I changed the text file, saved, and closed it. I then opened the same text file in the iDisk folder, and of course, the changes weren't there. As I feared, the iDisk just made a copy, not a synced file. Then I started thinking about it, and I said, well, wait a minute. They got that syncing thing over there in System Preferences. So I opened up the Mobile Me Preference pane, and if you click on iDisk Sync Start, then this will keep a copy of your iDisk on your computer, because right now your iDisk is just sitting up in the cloud. So you'd keep that folder, that test folder, for example, inside the iDisk folder, not outside of it like my test case. Then any changes to the items in that folder and in all of the iDisk will be synced to the cloud. Then you can get to the files when you're not connected to the net. I think that's going to do exactly what you really want. I did notice, though, that you use Dropbox to give me your recording. I think that's actually the easier tool to use instead of iDisk. As you already know, Dropbox is free, and you can open a Dropbox account at getdropbox.com. You get 2 gigabytes of free storage there. Don't have to pay a dime. You get a desktop client and a web interface. If you drag a folder into your Dropbox, all of the data exists on your computer and in the cloud at the Dropbox. Any changes you make to it are synced automatically to the other location. You can even share those folders, like you did with me, and then the data exists in 3 places. Of course, since it's synced, any changes they make on the Dropbox folder on their side changes it on your computer as well. So, like, for example, if I take the file out of the folder you shared, then it would disappear on your end. I think overall you get some of the same functionality in Dropbox that you get in iDisk, but the iDisk comes with so much more baggage. I mean, it's got websites and all this other stuff it's trying to do. Because it does so much more, I think for simple file syncing like what you're talking about, Dropbox seems much more intuitive to me. I don't by any means pretend to be an expert on Mobile Me or iDisk syncing. I just did some experiments to try to figure it out. But I'd go with Dropbox for sure. Well, last week I promised I'd give you more on the Bold after I spent some time with it, the BlackBerry Bold. I decided right after the show to test out the Wi-Fi access on the Bold. I'm not sure that would be a big differentiator for me in buying the phone, because I don't have a lot of Wi-Fi access in my life except when I'm at home. When I'm at home, I've got my Mac, so it's not that big of a deal for me. But I know people were really disappointed that the Storm didn't have it. In any case, I went into the options menu. Usually it's a box wrench symbol, but of course mine looks like System Preferences on the Mac because of my iPhone theme. I was able to find the Wi-Fi connections easily. It scanned my network in a quick second, and it made it easy to enter my WPA password. I had to think how hard that would have been on the Storm. Oh, well, I guess I should stop beating a dead horse, right? I did have to figure out first whether the Bold is 802.11g or N because I run 2 networks at my house. I have all the N devices on the N network, and I don't let any of the G devices on it because they'll just slow it down. As I expected, the Bold is on G, which is actually fine. Once I was connected, it saved my connection with a name of my choosing for further reference. Could not have been easier. Now remember that when you visit a site with an iPhone, just about anybody who's anybody auto-detects the iPhone browser and makes their website look simple and readable for it. Even though BlackBerry still outnumber the iPhone, I think, for some reason no one detects their browser. So all the sites are pretty much unreadable at first. Way, way too small a text to read. RIM has built in a tool called Column View, which fixes that problem. I learned about it on the Storm, but it never quite rendered properly for me. On the Bold, it seems to work really, really well. I, of course, headed for podfeet.com first, and one click of that option from the menu, and I was able to see nice large text in a single column, and the graphics came in really nicely, too. They seemed to be a bit stretched tall, but at least I didn't have to scroll back and forth to see them. One drag is how slow the scroll is when you're on a web page. For some reason, the horizontal and vertical scroll sensitivity settings in the screen keyboard options have no effect on scrolling on web pages. I cranked them both up to 100 when the default is 70, and after I did that on normal screens and menu, my cursor was flying uncontrollably across the screen. So, but when I got back to a web page, it was this incredibly slow and annoying scroll. It took me a while to get back to the defaults to reset it back to 70, because hitting right on a menu pick with it set to 100 was nearly impossible. Hopefully I'll stumble across a setting I didn't know about soon that'll fix it. But the saving grace is that on the Bold, you can hit the space bar to scroll down a full page, just like on older model BlackBerries. Of course, you can't do that on the Storm because you have no keyboard. Shift space bar scrolls up a page, too, which is nice. Man, I miss that so much. And don't forget the wonderful T for top and B for bottom keys. It was also so nice to be able to get back to being able to hit the letter C from the main screen, because that brings up compose a new email. I mean, in one key, I can be starting a new email on the Storm. I think it was 17 buttons or something. Oh, it was just horrible. Well, while I'm still enamored with the column view, it does have its limitations. Like on Bart's blog over at bartb.ie, he has a left column, which means that when the Bold shows you the column view, it starts with the entire left column first. It's not until you've exhausted everything on that before you get to the real content. It also didn't render his blog very well in that mode. It had a vertical thin blue line throughout the text and some funny blue and white boxes separating each blog post. I haven't done a lot of great testing with this because, I'm just loving using it as a BlackBerry. I mean, email is what you get a BlackBerry for. I'm email. I am crazy maniac emailer again. I mean, I used to just dread reaching in my purse to get my Storm. It's like, oh man, now it's going to take me four tries to get my password in there. And then I'm going to have to start bringing up email. It's going to take forever. I'm going to have to do 17 clicks. Oh, forget it. I actually let the battery run out of it finally because I was so sick of it. Now I find that I get a little gleeful grin on my face going, ooh, get to play with my BlackBerry. Yay! So I definitely am liking the BlackBerry Bold a lot better than the BlackBerry Storm. And I'll keep you posted if I learn anything else interesting about it.
Hola, Allison. I just finished getting a 48 out of 50 on my Spanish oral examination, and I'm feeling pretty happy. Combine that with the 90-degree weather in January and the fact that Windows 7 just finished downloading and is installing in VirtualBox as we speak, and I'm in a good enough mood to record for you. 90 degrees isn't bad in January, eh? Your listeners might not remember this, but I'm also from the LA or Orange County area. It's too bad I don't drive a Honda or an Acura. Well, if you've been wondering why I haven't spoken to you in so long, it's quite frankly because my audio quality really depressed me. If you're wondering why I'm recording for you again now, then this may give you a hint. I'm now coming to you live from the blue snowflake microphone placed right in front of my nose. Okay, not literally, but you get the idea. Thanks to Stu Helm from stuhelm.com for giving this to me as both a birthday present and pretty much a bribe to get me on his podcast, which you can find at iampodcast.tv. Now that I've gotten IMP's plugin, it's time for me to tell you how awesome I think this microphone is. It's the little cousin to Blue's Snowball microphone, which is a microphone that's about the size of my head, so not very portable. This is their portable variety. When it's all folded up and put away, it's pretty much the size of a deck of cards, except it's about an inch tall, which a deck of cards isn't. The actual mic part pops up in a little bump that's pretty much as big as your thumb and forefinger making a circle together. To unfold it, you simply take the white part that's covering three of the four sides and the bottom, and slide it off of the aluminum part that's covering the top and one other side. You may be able to tell that I'm kind of trying to do this with the one part that I'm not using while I'm talking to you, and that's why I sound all funny. But the point is then that you push up on the little bump where it shows up on the reverse side. You'll get it when you see the mic. And then the microphone flips out and becomes a little stand. Now, the mic head itself is about round, and as I told you, it's about the size of the thumb and forefinger, making a circle together. The head is mounted on a swivel stick, so you can swivel it any which way you want, which includes the way where you won't be able to hear me. And then, that swivel stick is itself mounted on a hinge, so you can point it down and hit the table with it, or point it up and point it at yourself. Okay, I'm going to stop picking it up and moving it now, but one of the snowflake's advantages to its design is that you can actually hook it over the screen of your laptop. So, it has a curved section. The mount is curved. It has padding on both sides that would contact your laptop, so it obviously doesn't scratch since both are made out of aluminum, if you have one of the most recent ones. Well, with the microphone, that's pretty much all there is to say. The construction, which is very nice, and the build quality, which is also very nice, and the audio quality, which, as you can hear, is very nice. So, I would highly recommend this to any podcaster who wants a better microphone than their crappy iSight mic, which you pretty much should, as Allison has said many times in the past. It's even optimized for podcasting or other vocals. And the price is right, too. It's only $79, or, on Amazon currently, it's selling for just about $50, which is a great bargain. At Macworld, Blue also came up with their cousin. I wouldn't call it a little brother, I wouldn't call it a big brother. I'd call it their cousin to the snowflake, the eyeball. The eyeball is pretty much a snowflake in darker colors. It's got a darker aluminium part. And no, it's not aluminum, it's aluminium. Didn't you hear Johnny Ive? The main feature of the eyeball, and the one that gives it its name, is the retractable webcam in it. So it's pretty much a replacement for the old iSight discontinued external models. Of course, I'm not sure if Blue would put it that way, but that's pretty much what it acts as. You can, of course, use it as a real snowflake, or you can tell it to send video, too. So if you want to Skype conference, if you have one of the older Mac Mini or MacBook Pros that didn't come with a 24-inch screen with a, whatchamacallit, a thingamabobber, a webcam and display, then it's great for that. If you want this added functionality, the eyeball will run you $139.99 list price, or $99 off Amazon, and that's, of course, in US dollars. Well, that's it for this review. My copy of Windows 7 waits, taking all my memory with it seems, and so does this nice carton of blueberries that I have right next to me. Enjoy the heat or the cold, everyone, depending on where you're living. And, as always, have a great episode. Bye-bye.
Hey, thanks for that review, Will. You know, it was funny. At first, I was nervous because you said you stopped doing reviews because your audio was inferior. And I'm thinking, wow, Will, it sounds kind of hissy and weak right now. And then suddenly you chime in with a snowflake. Definite improvement.
George from Tulsa with an iTunes tip. Big Trouble. That's the Dave Barry audiobook I purchased from the iTunes store. My big trouble started when I synced the book to my Nano. Big trouble transferred, but brought along a podcast graphic instead of its own. When I tried to sync again, iTunes crashed and crashed and crashed. My ripped music and podcast synced just fine, but nothing with DRM from the iTunes store. More confusing, my touch continued to sync everything. I wasn't able to find a solution on the Apple support site or in Apple support discussions. Google revealed several possible solutions. Of course, the last one, the one that worked after hours wasted, was the easiest. Open iTunes, deauthorize the computer, reauthorize it. I've sent Allison more, including links to iPod and iTunes fixes. Hope you don't need them, but they're interesting in a geeky way. Oh, and write your congressperson to protest DRM and the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, because they're the real problem.
Well, thanks for sending in that tip, George. I bet it'll really help some people out. I couldn't agree more that the Digital Millennium Copyright Act is a terrible law. So George loves to teach and help others, and he sends me screenshots and text of his lessons, but he didn't use ScreenSteps to do it. Of course, I suggested that to him, but he had a problem with the way the lessons would split across pages. I was confused by that because that's one of the delightful features of ScreenSteps, because you never have to mess with silly things like text crossing over from page to page or any problem with the images. I asked George to send me an example, and it turned out he had found a bug in the software. The way he was putting in a whole lot of text at the very, very beginning part of the lesson was causing some flaws in the way the images would cross over from page to page. I sent his package file off to the great guys over at ScreenSteps.com, and they jumped right on it, and they're incorporating the fix into the next version 2.5. That's what I love about using ScreenSteps to document lessons and tutorials. If I ever find anything wrong, I know the developers have my back and will fix any problems I might have, and they'll keep improving the product, doing things I never thought to ask them for. So, George downloaded the beta of version 2.5, and guess what? He loved it. He's sold on it now. George bought ScreenSteps, and he was smart enough to use my coupon code NOSILLA, which is my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, to get 25% off. Oh, I should mention that this deal is better than the educational discount. So don't try to use the educational discount. Use the NOSILLACAST, coupon code. If you want to know more about ScreenSteps, head on over to ScreenSteps.com and watch their short tutorial videos to learn more. One of the folks I follow on Twitter, and I wish I could remember who it was, sent out a tweet about a graph showing age and gender demographics on usage of social media tools like Facebook and MySpace. It sounded pretty cool, so I clicked on the link, and it took me to a site called insocialmedia.com. The unfortunate part was that in order to see the link, I had to join social media. The good news is that I'm all about social media and I join everything that looks fun, so I jumped right in with no clue to what I was joining. Yeah, what the heck. I think they could improve on that so that if you didn't have a clue, in social media would kind of give you a better idea of what it was before you joined, but I'm here to tell you what it is. In social media is a very intriguing site. Their tagline is, In Social Media is a hand-picked group of social media experts and enthusiasts that encourage, educate, and develop relationships together. Well, hand-picked is interesting since I was able to jump in and join, but the rest of it sounds pretty close to what I'm finding. Once you join In Social Media, it has a menu bar that gives you a flavor for what you can do in here. There's My Page, Members, Photos, Videos, Forum, Events, Groups, Blogs, Chat, and Invite. The blog thing is interesting. You go in and you blog, and it becomes part of an In Social Media blog stream, which is pretty cool. It's like you've subscribed to everyone's blog at once. Normally, that would be kind of annoying, but since the defined subject is social media, and that's the area of interest for me and the reason why you would join this, most of what the people say are fascinating to me. The forums are just starting to become fun. They had subjects like, what features make for a good social media site, or cool web-based stuff for you. Maybe you guys think that all sounds like drivel, but for me, it's candy. I took a look at photos, and people are sharing personal photos there. Now, you know, I'm really into sharing personal photos on Facebook. That's what that tool is about. It's about your life. To me, and social media is more about technologies and tools. Why would I put up a picture of my son on a water slide there? Maybe I'd put up the photos I took at Macworld Expo, at least the ones of the products, but personal photos just don't seem to fit right here. I suppose to each his own, but that's the way I look at it. I decided to go ahead and upload a few photos from Macworld, but I ran into a fail on In Social Media when I did that. They have an individual photo uploader and a Java-based bulk uploader, but it wouldn't recognize Java on the Mac at all. It said I needed a new version and to go to java.com to get it. Poop. I don't want to sit there and do photos one by one. That's boring. Well, the videos are interesting. People post videos in the normal places like Vidler or YouTube, and then they link to them within In Social Media. Good for In Social Media, of course, because it's not using their bandwidth, but it's kind of nice because it's a collection point for all this stuff about social media. I'm not sure where In Social Media will go in the long run, or whether it's really going to resonate to everyone, but for me, I think it'll be a fun place to hang out for a while. Well, it's time for me to talk about Honda Bob. It's just me. Only me. It's not Alex the computer. It's not Rose from Australia. It's not a Klingon warfighter. It's not the Irish guys. Nobody interesting. It's just me. I'm sorry to disappoint, but it's just going to be me telling you about my mechanic, my hero, the guy who's been taking care of my car for 30 years. Not the same car, different cars. All our cars. He's the guy who drives to our house and works on our cars while we relax in the house. Well, actually, I relax in the house and Steve tortures him with questions about everything he does. Honda Bob is the man who patiently teaches Steve, and he teaches through his website at hdabob.com. He's the man who gives me peace of mind about our cars and high resale value because our cars run perfectly so much longer than even you expect from the well-built Hondas and Acuras. And if you're lucky enough to live in the L.A. or Orange County areas, you too could have outstanding and convenient in-home care for your Honda or Acura. You can give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or send him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. Happy Valentine's Day, Bart.
Yay! Thanks, Allison.
Oh, well, let's see. We've got a big, big show today. You found a really cool product that's going to be a lot of fun to talk about. But let's, as always, start out with Security Lite. What's new on the security front this week?
Well, this week contained the second Tuesday of the month, which Windows users should know as Patch Tuesday. Usual mishmash of stuff, some of it rated critical, so let your Windows update.
Alrighty, so as always, run your Windows update, but I think we have some fun on the Mac front. Do we have an arbitrary code execution?
Yeah, all the usual stuff. Okay. So we have a security update 2009-001 and a Java update as well. So there's loads and loads of stuff in the security update, but at least one of them is remote code execution, again, through a video format. Videos really seem to be a vector of choice these days for bad guys. Hey, go to this webpage, look at this video, haha, now we own you.
Oh, with not download this codec, but just looking at it gets you?
Yeah, assuming there's appropriate flaws in the... in the way the operating system handles the video, then, yeah, you don't need to get them to do a codec. You can just exploit their existing operating system. So, again, Apple is patching all this stuff as it comes to light. But it's a good reason to patch. There's lots more stuff in that update. But generally speaking, I just scroll down until I see one that says remote code execution. Then I go, okay, this is important.
Now, on the Windows side, I know one of the reasons they really like to exploit the Windows boxes is to be able to create a botnet, right? Once you can control the computer, you create a botnet, and then that botnet can be sold to people who blackmail websites and do denial of service attacks, all that kind of thing. What's the fun in owning a Mac? I mean, if they own your machine,
they sign you up to a botnet. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah, well...
iServices Trojan that came out there a week or two ago does. It signs you up to a botnet.
Okay, so those botnets can work just as well. You can add the Macs to the Windows botnet. I always picture somehow separately.
But when you think about it, these botnets are used for denial of service attacks, which is literally everyone go fetch this web page at the same time so the web server crashes.
So they just have to write different code to run on the Mac to say, go to this server at this time when I push go kind of thing.
Yeah, okay. I mean, yeah, and most of the stuff is done over IRC is how the command and control of these things tend to work. So, yeah, they might have to do a little bit of different work, but at the end of the day, you know, not that much different than they are starting to sign up your Macs into the botnets. You know, a bot is a bot.
Yeah, that's true. For some reason, that seemed like it would be different, but now that you mentioned it, I guess not. And, of course, there's always the, know your passwords and that sort of thing. That's always fun to get in your bank accounts and all that.
Well, the standard keylogger and all that kind of carry on, yeah. So, I mean, nowadays, 1 in 10 machines is a Mac, so expect more of this rubbish.
Yeah. And did I remember to mention the how angry I was at collegeboard.com? Did I bring that up yet? So collegeboard.com is who manages what's called FAFSA. It's a financial aid form that every kid going away to college has to fill out. And this is very, very detailed with all of your family's financial information. And it has to be verifiable financial information. So there's, all kinds of great things in there and, information you probably would want others to have. And we got an email this week. Yeah, we did all that just like we're supposed to. But we got an email this week that said, click on this link in this email, log in using your social security number and your birthday.
What?
It was not a phishing scam. It was the College Board. They're telling people, click a link and enter the two pieces of information most likely to allow you to have everything you own stolen. I was appalled by this, and I wrote to them, and they wrote back a canned, we'll get back to you in 24 hours thing. And that's it. Haven't gotten anything back from them.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect much.
Is that unconscionable, though? I mean,
but it's easy from their point of view because they have that information. So, this is private information, so we can use it to verify that you are who you say you are.
Right.
But
and in the process, get you entirely accustomed to giving out this sensitive information over the internet.
Exactly. But I think that's the little tidbit right there that bothers me a little bit. So, well, anyway, never do that, just so you guys know. Don't ever, ever, ever do that. Let's go on to something
fun. Unless it's the College Board.
No, I still didn't do it. I'm refusing to give them the information.
Would that mean that they're just going to refuse to give you the money?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I'm really, you know, winning there. So
yeah, that's big time.
Anyway, well, you found a really interesting product this week that we've both been playing with and having some fun. Why don't you fill everybody in?
I should set the scene, shouldn't I?
Yes.
It's something that most people probably know, because I have a habit of mentioning it, that I am a Thunderbird user rather than a Mail.app user, and have been for a very long time, before I was a Mac user even. I've been using Thunderbird since long before I went 1.0, back in the days when Firefox didn't exist yet, and it was called Firebird, having recently changed from its original name of Phoenix.
Oh,
and,
I remember that.
Thunderbird's icon used to be this blue phoenix rising up out of a fire, and Firebird was this red fire bird. So they were sort of more related, and the two of them were much more of a team. And since that time, Mozilla has been neglecting Thunderbird more and more, and they don't really seem to care. First it was just neglected, and then it was outright abandoned. It was kicked out of the real Mozilla project and is now a sub-company within Mozilla that has to fend for itself. The head developer sod it off because he thought this was kind of poor show, and it is. And at the end of the day, what this means is that Thunderbird has languished. It's a good mail client, but it has not had any major innovation lately because it's just been abandoned by Mozilla. Thankfully, it's open source, which means that anyone can take it upon themselves to resurrect the project. And one of the guys who was involved with it when Mozilla did care about it and then left has taken the code base and created a new mail client from it called Postbox, which is
there we go.
Released as a beta this week, and it's what we've been playing with all week.
I think about this. I definitely remember using Thunderbird, but I think it was probably in the OS 9 days before there was a Mac client that was really any good, a mail client
right.
for Mac.
I didn't even know that Thunderbird had worked on OS Classic, but again, I wasn't a Mac user in them days, so I wouldn't remember.
In them days. Yeah, I think so, because I know I haven't used it in, it's got to be pushing 10 years. I mean, it seems really, really far back the last time I used it. So this is open source, but and you can get it at postbox-inc.com.
Yeah.
So this is a polished, finished product or not?
Well, no, it's a beta, and it's as betas go, it's actually quite polished, but I have stumbled into at least one bug, and I don't know, you may have stumbled into some more. We should probably mention that, although Thunderbird is Windows, Linux, Mac, this beta version of Postbox is just Windows and Mac. Linux is apparently coming, but it's not there yet, and I imagine this is because they're tying Postbox in much more tightly to the relevant OS. Mm-hmm. So on Mac OS X, it ties into your Apple address book. I'm imagining, although we haven't tested it because neither of us are really Windows users, that on the Windows end it will tie into Outlook or something like that.
So at the risk of saying something nice at the beginning, I know you like to tell us everything you hate first. that was the first thing that I really liked, was that I didn't have to import my address book to test it. It uses my standard address book. So I can switch back and forth between mail.app and Thunderbird, and Postbox, and test it out. And I was able to get full access to everybody I wanted to talk to. So that was a really nice immediate benefit to getting to play with it.
Yeah, and the other thing, of course, is that now that most of us, I hope, are using IMAP rather than the ancient and rather out-of-date POP3, we can switch clients at the drop of a hat because our mail isn't on the client, our mail is on the mail server, so it doesn't matter how we access it.
That made me so happy when I realized that. I was just like, yay! But I did wonder, in just one email account alone, I had about 3,500 messages. Do I now have two copies of those 3,500 on my hard drive, probably?
No, you have copies of the headers for those messages.
Oh, so they're not stored on my hard drive at all? They're only on the...
I don't know how Apple Mail does it. I have a feeling Apple Mail may cache everything.
I thought it did.
Thunderbird will only cache folders you tell it to cache.
Oh, cool.
And I'm imagining Postbox does the same. What Postbox does do is it indexes all of your mail so that it searches very quickly and very deeply. And so that index is also on your machine.
So is it searching on Gmail, for example? I mean, it's going up to the server and indexing what's on the server at Gmail?
Yeah.
Oh.
Now, it indexes it the first time you try to do a search. Well, it says it indexes in the background, so depending on how long you've had it running, it may have already done it.
Mm-hmm.
But if it hasn't indexed when you do a search, it'll give you a yellow bar that says, you know, warning, these results may be incomplete because your indexing hasn't happened. Do you want me to index now?
Yeah, I did see that.
Yeah, so then you just click yes, and then it'll go off and index.
I'm not sure it ever actually did it, though. One of the things that I found I was excited about but didn't work was Facebook integration. There's a thing that just says, turn on Facebook in here, and you click that, and it launches a web browser, and Facebook has to grant permission to any tools that try to access it, which is a security thing, which is great. And so I told the web browser, I told Facebook, yes, go ahead and let it do that. And it came back, but it never seemed to, in theory, what I was supposed to be able to do is write to people that were my friends in Facebook. And I have a lot of friends in Facebook who are not in my address book. So I tried a couple of the usual suspects, and I wasn't able to access them. And then it said it had to index, and only had about 10 or 15 names. It said it had to index, but it never seemed to really finish. Maybe I was supposed to let it run for hours or something, and maybe I didn't give it enough time. But I was also supposed to be able to update my status in Facebook from Postbox, but I could never find a menu pick to do that. And I read online even. I even looked at the instructions, and it didn't tell me how to do that. I know. Perish the thought.
Yeah, I can't say it's something I've run into because we all know my opinions on Facebook.
Well, aren't you glad something didn't work with Facebook, though? That's got to make you happy, right?
Well, I wouldn't go that far. I just don't care.
Now, did you notice that growl support was enabled by default? I know you hate that.
Yeah, which is nice.
Oh, you said you hated it on an earlier application. You were whining about it?
No. That was when it went and installed growl behind my back.
Oh, you're right. Oh, okay.
A subtle difference between using growl when it's there and making growl be there without asking me or telling me.
Okay, I got you. That's okay then.
I was happy because Thunderbird does that too, so I was happy to see that.
Yeah, that's kind of neat. So why don't you tell us what you hated about it?
Okay, well, I suppose what I found a bit disappointing was that, it's a new start for Thunderbird, and it's certainly added a lot to Thunderbird, but unfortunately, a lot of the not-so-good features of Thunderbird have migrated over as well.
Their features?
So. Yeah, so something I found particularly infuriating about Thunderbird's new account wizard is that it does not allow you to specify encryption. Now, 20 years ago, perhaps even 10 years ago, that was fine because people did not encrypt their email. It was a more innocent time, and having plain text passwords floating around the internet was the norm. You had Telnet, FTP, you name it, passwords were just out there, and people just assumed, I guess, that no one would be naughty enough to sniff them. But now we live in a day of open Wi-Fi where everything you send in plain text can be grabbed by automated tools that don't even involve any effort. So you really cannot afford to have plain text passwords floating around. Now, lots of people's email is still done in plain text, but those people whose mail server supports encryption, and if your mail server doesn't, I would say it's time you changed. Those people don't get the option within the wizard to set that up. You have to go back in and edit the settings afterwards and add it in, and it really should be an option right there in the wizard.
Is that that?
It's not an afterthought.
Is that the SSL thing we did later?
SSL or TLS. Okay. Like Thunderbird, Postbox supports both encryption protocols.
Okay, so I've got that going now, I guess, where you showed me to turn it back on that did work?
Gmail being smart do not let you access their servers without encryption, which is why it wasn't working for you until you turned that on.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, so that's kind of unfortunate that they don't automatically go through and say, would you like to use secure?
Yeah, it should be an option in the wizard. It is fundamental information, just like what server you have.
Okay.
So I'm disappointed. The other thing that has always been, how can I say this politely, a cluster F*K, has been how Thunderbird deals with multiple SMTP servers. Again, this is a time warp issue. Back in the olden days, every ISP would have an SMTP server for all their customers to use, and you would use that SMTP server to send all email. So you would specify one. But nowadays, that's not how things are done. Your outgoing mail server is different for all your different accounts, and it will usually be from whoever gives you your email. So you use Gmail as your outgoing server for your Gmail accounts. You, if you had accounts still with GoDaddy, you would use GoDaddy as your outgoing server for that account. So if you have three or four accounts, you're going to have three or four SMTP servers. But that's right. Not easy to do. That is exceptionally counterintuitive to do in Thunderbird. It can do it, but it involves you going down to that outgoing servers tab at the very bottom, adding in an entry, then going back up to the account you care about, and not in the servers tab, but on the front page for that account, specifying the SMTP server to use.
Now, let's make sure we're absolutely clear on this. I had no idea how to do it, and the only reason I was able to attach the right outgoing mail server to my account was because Bart had done it before in Thunderbird and knew the weird, bizarre path you had to do that. So, that was really convoluted.
Yeah, and that involved lots of Googling on my part.
And I would have thrown that application out. I would have just said, oh, I can't use it, because I'd given up. I wasn't able to send mail with my podfeet.com email because I'd already used that outgoing mail server for my first account. In fact, it doesn't even ask you what outgoing mail server you want.
No, it assumes you want to use the same one.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's an old, outdated assumption that was once correct, is not correct, and should have been corrected a decade ago.
Yeah, definitely.
Then finally, the other bit of Thunderbird's silliness that has followed its way over is how it deals with folders within IMAP. Now, our mail server in work has a really nifty feature. I don't know how standard it is, but it's in our server in work, and I love it to pieces. So rather than setting up my mail rules on the client, our server lets me specify the mail rules on the server. So they happen first.
Okay.
So my mail never goes into my inbox if it's going to be filtered. It goes straight into the appropriate folder right there on the server. So no matter what client I use, all of my mail is still appropriately sorted.
Sure.
But that means that new mail doesn't only show up in my inbox. New mail shows up all over the place. And Thunderbird only checks the inbox for new mail. It doesn't check any of the other folders. So those will never go bold with a little number next to them. So you could have 500 new messages and not know about it. Unless you go to each single folder in one by one, right-click on it, go to Properties, and then click a little checkbox that says check this folder for new mail, and you do that in every folder. And then it works properly. Why can't it just work?
Well, I think one of the things that's different about, and maybe I'm not sure I'm hitting the exact same thing, is that in mail.app, for example, they have you have all of your inboxes together, then you have all of your sent mail together, then you have all of your trash together. And in the case of the way you like it is where all of the everything associated with one one mailbox is together. So for nocillacast@gmail.com, I would have an inbox, an outbox, a sent mail, and a trash. And then for podfeet.com, I would have the same set of things.
Yeah. Which is how it really works on the server. Because you don't have one inbox. You have lots of inboxes, and Apple sort of pretends you don't. And I find that really infuriating. I very much sort of switch from account to account mentally. I am now dealing with work stuff, therefore I go here. I am now dealing with personal stuff, therefore I go here. I don't want them all mixed in together. And that's the biggest reason I've never used mail.app. Thunderbird has been very good at keeping them separate, and so has Postbox. The interface is a little different between the two, but they both maintain that segregation.
Now, the thing I didn't like about that is that makes it a little bit harder to do searches, because you have to be in the right mailbox to start the search, though. Because there isn't really an all-mail kind of button, is there?
I was pretty sure that Postbox did search everywhere. Thunderbird is a little less good about that. You have to just search the right account. But I was pretty sure Postbox did it globally.
Because
I don't remember choosing a folder, and I do remember it finding all the right email. I'm not 100% sure on that. I may have accidentally selected the right folder and then done a search.
Yeah, I'm not sure, because I don't know. Well, let me see. I'm going to try it right now. Okay, that was a bug. When I clicked in the search box, the entire thing collapsed up just to be the menu bar at the top, and I didn't think it meant to do that. So let me do a search on Bart, and I can't really tell. I don't know how to tell whether it's done it from all the different ones or not. Yeah, I'm not sure. It's unclear to me. I guess I'd have to find something I know isn't in any of the other mailboxes. Well, anyway.
Yes, anyway.
And of course, I haven't indexed him yet. I just noticed it says I didn't do it yet, so.
And then you're not going to get very far. I did index the stuff at work. It didn't take particularly long, and the search was really snappy after it. I was very impressed.
Let's see. I've got 4,675 messages in my mobile me account alone. Let's see how it does. I don't Bart my mail, can you tell?
Yeah, I don't. There's a lot of stuff I don't Bart anymore because we've good searching. Just not my photographs. I'd like to keep them sensible. Anyway, something else that annoyed me is that I was very fond of color coding messages in Thunderbird. If you hit the one key, a message would turn red and get marked as important. If you hit the two key, it would turn blue and get marked as to do. And so I would scan through my inbox looking for red and blue mails and dealing with them, and then changing them to not colored when I was done. So I also had Smart Folder set up to pick out mail that had been tagged in those two ways.
Oh, that's
so
good idea.
I very much got used to that color coding and that Smart Folder structure. And the color coding is gone. I can still mark stuff using what they call topics, is what they call them.
Yeah,
you can create your own topics.
Those are like tags, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
But it's not visually going to jump out at you. But you could go to all the things that are tagged to do.
Yeah, so you get that half. You get the Smart Folder half, but you don't get the color coding, and that was something that was very important to me. So that annoys me. That's the one thing that's making me think twice about making this a permanent change.
Hmm.
Another thing that I think is very cool is the way it does message threading. So when you have a bunch of related
messages threading. This will be interesting. What do you like?
It collapses them into a single message with a little triangle next to it. So if you click on the single message, you see all the messages in one big document, or you can collapse a triangle and click into individual messages.
Doesn't every mail application do that?
No.
Apple
That's
Mail.
That's a recent modern feature.
I don't know. Lotus Notes does it.
Okay. Well, it's certainly not something Thunderbird does by default. You can turn it on in Thunderbird as an option, but it's by no means the default. And what I have noticed here is that I get XML errors from time to time. So there's definitely some bugs in how it does this. Mm-hmm. So if I have a thread full of HTML messages and I click on the uncollapsed or the collapsed version of it to see everything at once, I get an XML error.
Hmm.
But when I when I open it up so I can see into it and then click on individual messages, that works fine.
I got to tell you, the reason I don't like the way they did the message threading is they don't pick up something that I've always really liked. Every week, I get a NoSilicast backup of my website. Mm-hmm. And Apple Mail is smart enough to make those be in a thread because they all have the same subject. So I could delete last week's and hang on to this week's every time it gets sent to me. But in Postbox, it didn't notice that I had another email with the identical title. So I had to go searching through my mail to go delete that old one. Now, I don't want to keep all these older versions.
Yes.
So I wish it had picked that up. Now, I do want to say Apple Mail has a bug that apparently only affects Allison Sheridan, because I can't find anybody who's seen this. But if I have a threaded discussion comes up, and I live on Thread, so I can make sure I answer the right one, right? If you see 15 answers to something. It's also nice if you're in a message group and somebody's talking about, I don't know, something you don't care about, like database applications that I don't play with. I can delete them all in one quick shot. But the problem is when I click on it, it folds down, and then I start going down with my mouse to click on the one I want, and it folds back up again. And then I click on it a second time, and now it'll stay open. It happens virtually every single time I get a threaded message, and I'm the only one on the planet, apparently, who's seen this.
Strange. That certainly would be infuriating.
Yeah, it's getting pretty old. It was entertaining for the first couple of weeks, you know, but it's getting old.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So anyway, back to Postbox.
Yeah, so one last thing, which I'm counting as a disappointment rather than a flaw or something really bad. Thunderbird is cool because, like Firefox, it supports plugins. So if Thunderbird doesn't do something, the chances are there's a plugin to make it do that.
Oh.
Postbox does not support plugins.
Oh, but it is beta, so maybe it's just not there yet.
Yeah, exactly. We don't know if it's going to stay away, but right now, this minute, it does not. So if you're a Thunderbird user who's heavily dependent on plugins, you cannot change.
Yeah. Okay. For now.
For now. Yeah, we don't know how that's going to evolve, but, you know, it's something I think is worth noting. I did use a few plugins, but none of them I can't live without, so I've switched, and I'm happy enough.
You know, we really should send this link to this recording into your detailed review on your website to the Thunderbird or to the Postbox team so they can take a look at it. So it might be kind of interesting. Yeah. So
we
what about
self-importance? Look at us. We know so much. Go listen to our review.
Absolutely. Hey, why not?
Yeah, true.
Now,
anyway,
there are just some things that you're excited about, right?
Absolutely. Straight off the bat, without a shadow of a doubt, tabs. Tabs are brilliant. Yahoo Mail has gotten me to love tabbed email in their web-based client. I love the idea of tabs, and I've always found it really clunky that Thunderbird insists on opening a new window when you want to view a mail.
Actually, now that I think about it, I would really like that. I haven't used that at all in Thunder in Postbox yet, but in mail, I just end up with these windows open all over the place because I want to remember to deal with them.
Yeah. Yeah, and as well, Thunderbird, if you have a window open and you double-click another mail, it goes into that same window. It's like, yeah!
Yeah. Oh, that's even
worse. So here, it's tabs building up. It's great. It's fantastic. So I really like that. That's a really good addition. Another fantastic addition, and in fact, the next two have both been taken, or, well, I mean, it's perfectly legitimate to take stuff in open source. That's kind of the point. But they both have their origins in Firefox 3, and nothing in Thunderbird has ever come from Firefox 3 because Thunderbird stagnated before Firefox 3 came out.
Mm.
First thing is security exceptions. In the old versions of Firefox, Firefox 1 and 2, whenever it came across a cert it didn't like, you had to okay that cert every single time. It was very annoying. In Firefox 3, when a cert came up, you added a permanent exception for it. So you looked at the cert, you examined it, you said, yeah, I'm happy with this, and then from that moment forward, Firefox 3 remembers that this is a cert that you have agreed to accept, even though theoretically it's not valid for some reason. Maybe it's out of date, maybe the name doesn't match the server, whatever. You know, for some reason, it doesn't see it as a valid cert, but you have chosen to accept it, and it remembers that and doesn't annoy you again. In mail servers, especially when you run your own, it's quite normal to have an invalid cert because it costs money to have your cert signed by a certificate authority. If it's your mail server that only you are going to use, why would you waste your money? So you use a self-signed cert. It gives you every bit as much security and encryption, but it's not going to automatically validate. So with Postbox, you simply set up an exception. You say, yes, I know this cert is signed by me and I'm not a trusted certificate authority, but trust this cert. Only tell me if this cert changes, because then there's a man-in-the-middle attack going on. And it just leaves you alone. It says, okay, I can do that, and it remembers. With Thunderbird, every single solitary time I launch Thunderbird, I have to tell it again and again and again, yes, that's my cert. I know it's not a valid certificate authority. Would you trust it, for goodness sake? So that I like.
Okay, good. There's another Firefox 3 style thing you like too, right?
Yeah, it's like very much the way Firefox 3 does its pop-up blocking is how Postbox does its image blocking. And it's very wise to block images by default because people running various scams collect email addresses like that. So they send out an email with an embedded link in it that the URL for the image contains the email address. And if that image is ever accessed, then they know that that's a real email address, even if you never reply or never do anything else. So they use it for harvesting and validating email addresses. That's why images are blocked. It's a really good idea. In Postbox, it pops up that little yellow bar you're used to seeing in Firefox 3 whenever it blocks a pop-up. It says, I've blocked images here. Do you want to make an exception? Yes, I do. And that's it. It'll never annoy you again for that from address.
Yeah.
So for Flickr, I tell it once, yeah, I trust Flickr. I want to see images because that's kind of the point with Flickr.
Oh,
and it just does it. It remembers.
I see.
Really
that's
nice.
Fantastic.
Yeah. The other thing which I really like, it's different. I don't think I've ever seen anything like it, is this sidebar thing they call the inspector.
Yeah, I like the inspector. I think that's really cool.
It confused me a little, but basically, the inspector is always on the right-hand side as a sidebar next to a mail message when you're viewing it. And everything that it considers important gets sucked out of the mail message and plopped into the sidebar. So if your mail message contains 5 or 6 URLs, they show up as a list of links. If your mail contains 5 or 6 images, they show up as little thumbnails. And if your mail contains attachments, they show up down the side with a little icon for their file type. So all of the important stuff in an email is sort of displayed in that little sidebar, and it's always there, which
is
really neat.
I'm not sure what I'll use it for, but it's very pleasing, and it seems like I would like to use that. I'm not 100% sure I would, but it just seems really cool.
Well, for me, I found two uses for it already. For a start, you can simply do a quick look-like view of an image. So if you see a thumbnail there, you click on it, it blows up in a separate little window, and you click again, and it shrinks back down again. So you can just quickly preview an image straight up.
But you can
and
do that
also
within a mail message, too.
And you can't within Thunderbird.
Oh, you can in Apple Mail. You can click on it and hit the space bar, and it pops up in quick look.
Okay, well, it's not something Thunderbird users
have had
the luxury of.
Okay.
They can only see it full size in line underneath the message, which is annoying.
Yeah, okay.
And all your instead of having to scroll down to the bottom of your message to see your attachments, they're right there next to you.
Yeah.
Which
definitely.
Is nice. Confusing. I actually, I wasn't expecting them to be there. I was expecting them to be at the bottom because that's where attachments go, surely. Every mail client in the history of mail clients that I've ever used has done it that way. So I actually replied to someone in work to say, you forgot the attachment? To which they replied, no, I didn't learn to use your mail client. And then I notice it in the sidebar. It's like, oh, look, there it is.
Now, I'm curious what it would do. One of the things that I do like in Apple Mail is that you can have inline images. So someone can say, and here's a picture of us at Mount Rushmore, and then there's the photo, and here's a picture of us at the Taj Mahal, and there's another photo. I wonder if it's going to strip those all out and shove them over in the side so the text wouldn't go with it anymore.
I doubt it'll strip them out. I imagine it will have them in both places.
Oh, that's good. That would
but
be
you need, if you send me such an email with inline images, we can test that out.
Oh, good, good. There's something I really like is a there's these dark, stark menus that come up. Like if you click the topics button and to-dos, they just, I don't know, it's just really vivid. I mean, it just jumps out and it was really, I don't know, pleasing. I really enjoy those.
They're like the heads-up displays Apple uses.
Except they're not translucent. But they're not translucent. They're opaque. But yeah, that's exactly what it reminds me of.
Maybe they're not. Maybe they aren't translucent. Maybe they remind me of it so much I remember them being translucent, even though they're not.
But they're very vivid. They're just stark, and I liked them.
Yeah, and when you click on the headers of an email, you get a similar pop-up like that with sort of an address card of all the people involved in that email where you can easily click on a little button to send them all an email and stuff.
Right, right. I like those.
And the whole UI has been nicely cleaned up.
It's very just clean. It just feels very, very clean. I think the font size is a bit on the small size. I think it's about 8-point font, maybe 9 at the most in the field. And some of the little icons when you go to write a mail message are, I mean, they literally make Magic-El look huge. They're like half the size of Magic-El. And I think they could increase that just a teeny bit. We've got enough space there, I think.
Yeah, I think they may have been reacting. Sort of, it may be a backlash against Thunderbird having ridiculously big icons.
So they went the other way.
I think they may have overcompensated because Thunderbird, especially its new mail window, is not particularly clean. You couldn't call it clean.
I've got two things I really don't like, and maybe you figured out how to fix it. Is when I say to reply, it puts my message below the message instead of above, like standard mail clients. And I have not been able to figure out where to fix it.
Fix that. So why couldn't you fix it in the other one?
Because
so
I can't find the menu pick.
Yeah, I'm just having a quick look now.
I assume it's in there. But I don't think anybody writes their messages that way anymore, do they? I mean, that seems pretty non-standard to me.
Yeah. And I remember it annoying other people in Thunderbird. And I found a fix for it in Thunderbird. Now I can't remember where.
Okay. Well, if you do find it, we'll stick it in the show notes.
Yeah, it does exist somewhere. And I imagine it's going to be exact the same. It's probably another one of those Thunderbird hinky things inherited.
Yeah. Now, here's one thing. And again, I think that's an old school thing. I think that's the way it used to be, but nobody does it that way anymore. But I'll tell you one thing that's going to keep me from using it right now. And that is when a message has not been read, it's not big enough and bold enough. I can't see it. It does not jump out at me. I look at my mail and going, it says I've got one unread mail message, but I can't tell which one of these I haven't read. It's just slightly bold. It's just not vivid enough for me.
I hadn't had a problem with that.
Yeah, well, I mean, remember, I'm old. Let's keep that right out in mind here, you know. But it just does. I can't see it. I look at it and I go, I know one of those isn't red. And I go, maybe it's that one. Yes, it is that one. You know, it just doesn't stand out enough for me to be able to use it. That absolutely will stop me from using the client. I really like a lot of stuff about it, but I can't not be able to tell what I haven't read.
Does it? I don't actually have it in front of me now because I'm using it at work rather than at home. Does it do the thing that Thunderbird does where it puts a big blue star next to mails that are new?
Not that I can see.
Maybe it's... I wonder, is it a column you can drop in? Because in Thunderbird, you have a column that literally has a giant blue star next to new messages, which you can then use to sort messages by red status.
I don't know. I'm looking right now at my mail, and I do not see that any of my mail is unread in this mailbox in the top half. And I know I happen to know which one is not read because I've seen it over in mail.app, but I can't tell from this.
Okay, well, that's not a good sign.
No.
Is there a way for it to set up different columns on Thunderbird? That would be done on the very, very right-hand side of the headers. There's a little icon. It looks like a table with an arrow.
List all tabs, images, attachments, links, contacts.
No, literally on the bar with the headings, so it's a subject, sender, that kind of stuff.
Okay. Now it says topic, date. Oh, one of the things I think is funny, click to sort by junk status.
Yeah, that's a Thunderbird standard.
I wouldn't want to sort by junk status. Why would I?
You get all your junk together and delete it.
Why not just have it go into a spam folder instead of showing it to me?
Because it doesn't know for sure it's spam. You can choose how it deals with what it thinks is junk. It's a Bayesian filter, so it does learn as you tell it this is, this isn't. But by default, it marks it with an icon rather than deleting it just in case it gets it wrong.
That's odd. I would rather it just go away. I'm used to Apple Mail.
What if it's a false positive?
I don't know. Apple Mail, I just don't get that much junk. I mean, I hardly ever get junk mail. It might be bacon, not spam.
Do you know how much, you know, legitimate mail is being deleted then?
Nope.
What you don't know.
Doesn't bother me one little bit. Anyway. Okay, well, we'll look for that one later, too. I would bet it's in here somewhere, and if it is, if there's some way to, you know, make them bright green or something. But, yeah, I mean,
I see the dot. So if it says subject, because you just sent me a screenshot, and then there's subject, then dot, then from. Messages that are new will have a big blue star underneath in that column with the dot.
There it is. Okay. And by the way, screenshot I sent you was... it wasn't actually showing the ones that were brand new. So
I was just going to say there's no new mail in that screenshot.
Right. Well, that's what I was going, see, I can't see it. But I forgot I'd done a search by BART, and so the one that I had wasn't there. But it doesn't look like you can change the order of the columns.
If you click on the header, it changes the order.
No, I mean, I want to move that blue dot up over to the far left, so it's real vivid to me. And
it appears you can. You can make it wider or smaller.
Except not that column I can't make wider or smaller. I can make all the other columns wider or smaller, but not that one. I'd like to be able to move that over.
Huh. Okay, that's a little imperfection, but you do actually get used to looking for it one over.
Yeah, maybe that would work. I am used to seeing it on the left-hand side now that you mention it from the other one, so from mail.app. Well, that's interesting. Yeah. Anyway, well, that got me a little closer. Maybe I could stand it. I'll try it a little longer now. Let's see, what else do we have to say on that?
I'm pretty much done with my list. I'm happy with the inspector. I'm happy with the address book integration. I actually quite like the whole UI because it's nice and clean.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. I hate to, you know, it's not as much fun when we don't argue, but it is clean. It's just clean.
Yeah. We should probably stick a screenshot actually into the show notes.
Yes, I will do that. I will make a little note on a piece of paper instead of you. Oh, that was one thing I didn't like. To-dos. If you create a to-do, there isn't like a folder for your to-dos. They're just sprinkled throughout your email.
You can pin them. That was an option.
Pin them with a what?
That I found somewhere.
Yeah.
So all your to-dos filter up to the top.
Ah, okay. So I see.
Which is what I've decided to do.
Checkbox. Click to toggling pinning to-dos. Okay, I clicked it.
And all your to-dos should bubble up to the very top.
Okay.
I haven't tried setting up a smart folder because I think I should be able to do that.
Okay.
And then have all my to-dos in the smart folder, and then I'm back to where I used to be.
Oh, okay. That might be. We'll have to see. I do like being able to have topics so that those would be your smart folders, for example, right?
Yeah. Yeah, topics are nice because it's like a smart folder but without the effort.
Yeah, well, but you could create a smart folder by topic. Then you have the
but it does that automatically.
It does?
Yeah, your favorite topics down the side.
I have no idea what you're talking about. I've got
you have an accounts pane, you have a folders pane, and then you have a favorite topics pane.
Oh, look at that. Never mind. Oh, now that's interesting. One of the messages I had created a topic that said show notes, and then I got subsequent messages with the same subject, and they're all in that same topic area. So that's kind of cool.
Ooh, that's intelligent. I like.
That's very intelligent. I do like.
I approve.
Well,
this message. Anyway.
This has been really fun. We've never reviewed a single application that we've. Well, no, that's not true. We do applications all the time, but somehow this seemed like it was really fun discovery to do together. I enjoyed this.
Yeah, I have to say, it made my weekend work a lot more interesting to be running this instead of Thunderbird and taking notes and stuff like that.
Yeah. So again, it's called Postbox, and you can get it at postbox-inc.com.
Yep.
Well, I think that does it for this week, Bart.
Yes, next week, I don't quite know what's going to happen yet because I have to be at my niece's first birthday. So I may send in a recording. I don't really know. So we'll have to play it by ear.
Okay, sounds good. That sounds like a higher priority anyway.
Well, I think I will be in very, very, very deep trouble if I'm not there. With very good reason.
I agree. All right, Bart, we'll talk to you when we talk to you.
Indeed. And until then, happy computing.
Well, after Bart and I were done recording, he sent me a note, and it turns out that security update he referenced, I think it was 2009-001, that actually fixes the Safari RSS flaw we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks. So after you run that update, it is now safe to let Safari play with your RSS feeds. Well, that's going to wind up the show for this week. I want to make sure you keep sending in your dumb questions, your compliments, your complaints, whatever you got. Send me an email at allison@podfeet.com. Be sure to follow me at twitter.com/podfeet. And also try to come on over for the Ustream live event every Sunday night at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8. We have a great time in there, a lot of fun, good fun people. It's family friendly as well. One other thing I want you to do is if you're going to buy something at Amazon, click on my Amazon link and follow through it to get to what you want to buy. I get a little bit of money to help support the show, and I'd really appreciate the help. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.